Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This edition of The Week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. This week, two stories from The Scientist Daily News. One on threats to your oranges, and another on why you may have to question the use of a common population genetic marker. Then, senior editor Jeff Perkel reports on a study that questions whether enriched environments for mice are linked to neuron growth. First, a story by Ann Harding on the once and future threats to Florida's citrus crop. State and government officials are gearing up to release a Citrus Health Response Plan, or CHRP, for Florida, after calling a halt to efforts to eradicate the bacterial disease citrus canker. Meanwhile, Florida's citrus growers are facing a new, potentially more devastating threat, a bacterium called citrus greening, which has wiped out the citrus industry in many parts of Asia. After Hurricane Wilma in 2005, which helped transmit citrus canker, officials estimated that it would be necessary to rip out roughly one-third of Florida's citrus-growing acreage to continue with eradication efforts, which require removing all trees within 1,900 feet of an infected tree. The cost, $1.7 billion. Philip Berger, National Science Program Leader at the USDA's Center for Plant Health Science and Technology, told The Scientist that, quote, "Eradication just wasn't practical or feasible any longer," end quote. Now Florida farmers are dealing with another pathogen, citrus greening, also known as Huanglongbing, Chinese for yellow shoot disease. The bacterium was identified for the first time in Florida in September 2005 and is now present across the southern half of the state. Spread by the insect Citrus salide, the disease has wiped out the citrus industry in many parts of Asia, including China and Thailand, and now threatens Brazil, which has the world's largest citrus grower. Fruit from canker-infected trees isn't pretty, but it can still be juiced and thus remains commercially valuable. But citrus greening dramatically shortens the lifespan of citrus trees, making fruit inedible as the tree sickens. Alan Dodds of the University of California at Riverside says, quote, "Not too many pathogens kill plants. This one does," end quote. Dodds moderates plant diseases on ProMed Mail, a listserv of emerging infectious diseases. And while canker is fairly easy to detect, greening is tougher to spot. Symptoms can mimic those of nutrient deficiencies. The bacterium that causes the disease, Candiditas liberabacter asiaticus, invades the phloem, but it's not clear where it goes after that, and it's never been cultured in the lab. The University of Florida's Ron Brolansky, who works at the Institute for Food and Agricultural Science Citrus Research and Education Center in Lake Alfred, told The Scientist that PCR tests have been developed to identify the bacterium, but are only capable of detecting it in symptomatic trees. Measures spelled out in a draft of the Citrus Health Response Plan, written by the USDA, APHIS, and the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services Division of Plant Industry, focus largely on ensuring the new citrus plant stock is free of both diseases, and require that citrus stock or budwood sources be grown in insect-proof structures featuring double-entry doors with positive pressure displacement. Nursery industry officials have estimated that building such a greenhouse for 175,000 young trees would cost $2.5 million. In the meantime, scientists like Brolansky are working hard on getting the word out to growers on how to manage citrus greening, which he calls, quote, "our number one priority," end quote. Chester Roystasher, an emeritus professor at the University of California at Riverside, who's worked internationally on citrus greening and other citrus diseases, told The Scientist that with judicious spraying, the disease can be controlled. He says, quote, "Where you do not have a good control program, your trees will live anywhere from 5 to 8 years and die," end quote. But because the disease is new to Florida, he noted, it's not clear how frequently groves will have to be sprayed. Yet another danger is waiting in the wings, citrus tristeza virus, CTV. The virus has been present in Florida for years without causing serious damage, but the brown citrus aphid, Toxoptera citrusida, which can spread the virus more aggressively than its standard Florida vector, Aphis gossypii, recently arrived in Florida. Alan Dodds says, quote, "It's a much more effective vector," end quote. He predicts that the strains of CTV endemic to Florida will gradually become more virulent as Taxoptera spreads. Such CTV strains can cause stem pitting, which reduces the commercial value of citrus fruit. Next, Charles Choi reports on the trouble with a commonly used population genetics marker. One of the most widely used markers in population genetics, mitochondrial genetic diversity, does not accurately reflect the size and history of a population, according to a report in this week's issue of Science. This suggests natural selection may be acting on mitochondrial DNA, mtDNA, the authors note. Co-author Nicolas Galtier at the University of Montpellier in France told the scientist, quote, "This result opens questions. What is mtDNA adapting to?" End quote. mtDNA is widely believed to be nearly evolutionary neutral. Therefore, mitochondrial genetic diversity should increase as a species population size increases, and looking at mtDNA diversity should enable researchers to infer whether a species is advancing or declining. In the present study, the researchers assembled a database dedicated to sequence polymorphism by scanning GenBank and EMBL Bank. To check its reliability, they compared the resulting information on the nuclear DNA of 417 species and the mtDNA of 1,683 species with allosome data for 912 species, focusing on whether taxa with larger populations demonstrated higher diversity. The authors intuited that average diversity should be higher in invertebrates than vertebrates, as well as higher in marine and small organisms, relative to terrestrial and larger organisms, respectively. Using nuclear DNA and allozyme data, the researchers saw that the average diversity of invertebrate taxa was 4 times higher than that of vertebrates, the expected pattern. However, mitochondrial genetic diversity failed to reflect differences in expected average population size, instead staying remarkably similar across taxa. Galtier and his colleagues suggest the pattern of diversity in mitochondria could be explained by natural selection. Some beneficial mutations can mute variation in linked loci, a process called hitchhiking that mtDNA is especially prone to because of its relative lack of recombination. The larger a population gets, the more opportunities there are to accumulate adaptive mtDNA mutations. More adaptive mutations could freeze more hitched loci, the authors reasoned, perhaps explaining why mtDNA diversity remains similar across taxa, regardless of population size. Indeed, the authors found that 58% of amino acid substitutions appear adaptive in invertebrate mtDNA compared to 12% in vertebrates, supporting their notion that the rate of adaptive evolution is proportional to population size. Galtier noted that the natural selection pressures mitochondria could experience might include the genomic conflict between mitochondrial and nuclear DNA. Commenting on the study, Adam Iyer-Walker at the University of Sussex in England told the scientist, quote, "It's really surprising to see so much adaptive evolution going on. You wouldn't expect it of mitochondria, which are so involved in central metabolism," end quote. Also commenting on the study, David Foltz at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge told the scientist that these findings, quote, "raise some very interesting questions," end quote. Follow-up should involve examining mtDNA diversity at lower taxonomic levels to determine if population size has any effect and investigating the role of life history factors such as mode of reproduction or generation time, he added. David Rand of Brown University in Rhode Island described the paper as, quote, "a strong indictment of the use of mtDNA as a neutral marker," end quote. Still, he said he was concerned that the new study ignored rare polymorphisms, which would bias results toward positive selection. Says Rand, quote, "It would be useful to repeat the analyses with all polymorphisms included to see if the difference between invertebrates and vertebrates is upheld," end quote. Interestingly, humans do not display the same pattern Galtier and his colleagues found, Iyer-Walker noted, suggesting that humans may have a small population that adaptive evolution in the mitochondrial genome is very rare. Says Iyer-Walker, quote, "If you can find species like ours that likely have not undergone much adaptive evolution in their mitochondria, such as the other great apes, then it'd be interesting to look for a correlation between diversity and population size, end quote. Finally, senior editor Jeff Perkel reports on a study that questions whether enriched environments for mice are linked to neuron growth.
According to a study published this week in Nature Neuroscience, neurogenesis does not appear to be the reason why mice that live in enriched environments tend to exhibit certain behavioral changes, such as less anxiety, relative to mice living in standard housing. The conclusion contradicts the recent hypothesis that neurogenesis in the dentate gyrus, a region of the hippocampus, is the cause of certain behavioral effects of environmental enrichment, which also include improved learning. Commenting on the paper, Amelia Eich, assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, said, quote, "This paper is very interesting. It represents the next step in where the field of adult neurogenesis is going," end quote. To date, the study of adult neurogenesis has largely been correlative, Eich explained. Earlier research demonstrated that environmental enrichment, housing mice in larger, more complex environment, leads to both increased neurogenesis in the dentate gyrus and to behavioral changes, including decreased anxiety and improved learning and memory. Co-lead author Michael Drew, a postdoctoral fellow in Renee Henn's lab at Columbia University, told the scientists that this study set out to test directly whether new neuron growth actually causes those behavioral changes. The team used targeted X-ray irradiation to specifically abolish neurogenesis in the hippocampus while leaving other areas of the brain intact. Then, after waiting 2 months for irradiation-induced inflammation to subside, the mice were split into two groups, one of which was housed in standard mouse cages, the other in enriched housing. 6 weeks later, the mice were subjected to several tests, including the Morris water maze, which tests spatial learning, the novelty-suppressed feeding protocol, which measures anxiety, and a test of habituation to new environments. As expected, mice in enriched housing performed better in the spatial learning test and also exhibited less anxiety-like behavior, said Drew. Quote, "We saw that, as other people had reported, enrichment had pretty big effects on their behavior," end quote. However, the authors were surprised to find that irradiation did not block the effects of enrichment, which argued against a role for neurogenesis in causing those effects. Says Eich, quote, "The hippocampus does many things, has many functions. We don't know if adult neurogenesis is responsible for any of them. This paper shows that there's at least a few that neurogenesis is not responsible for," end quote. An open question is how broadly applicable these results are. Says Drew, quote, "It's certainly possible that there are other behaviors, or you could say psychological processes, that are affected by enrichment and that are neurogenesis dependent," end quote. For instance, this study seems to contradict earlier findings that linked neurogenesis and enrichment-induced behavioral benefits. Serge Laroche, head of the Laboratory of Learning and Memory at the University of Paris South in Orsay, participated in one such study. Laroche told the scientists that his study used different behavioral tests and different animals, rats rather than mice, than does the current research. Quote, "In this field of research, you can't generalize from one task to another because they probe different types of memory functions," end quote. Laroche's study, published in 2005, tested the effect of neurogenesis on enrichment-facilitated long-term memory, as measured in the novel object recognition test. Laroche suggested that perhaps enrichment facilitates both learning and long-term memory, but, quote, "the mechanism of neurogenesis perhaps is only implicated in mediating the facilitation of memory and not in mediating the facilitation of learning," end quote. According to Eich, the study of adult neurogenesis is in the middle of a technical evolution. From anti-cancer drugs to whole brain irradiation to targeted irradiation in the current study. The next step in that evolution, researchers say, is the development of genetic tools, such as inducible transgenic mice, to manipulate neurogenesis in vivo, non-invasively and precisely. Says Eich, quote, "Every approach gets us closer to figuring out what these new cells do, but the critical thing that is missing is a way to independently manipulate these cells. This is crucial," end quote.
Join us online at www.the-scientist.com for more of the Scientist Daily News, blogs on current events, controversies and conferences, and features from our May print edition. This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.